Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this first day of spring. Ta-da! March 31st, Wednesday. This hour of the program, we're going to have a terrific hour. We'll be looking at the beginnings of morality in primate behavior. Dr. Franz de Waal was with us some time ago. He is director of the Living Link Center at Emory University. It was established in 1997 for primate studies that shed light on human behavioral education. It's an integrated part of the Yerkes Primate Center, the nation's oldest and largest such center, and the goals are to reconstruct human evolution, to pinpoint differences and similarities between humans and non-human primates, to educate the public about primates and promote their well-being and conservation. Dr. de Waal was originally from the Netherlands, trained as a zoologist, and he has a PhD in biology from the University of Utrecht. His dissertation research concerned aggressive behavior and alliance formation in macaques. In 81, he came to the States and the Wisconsin Regional Primate Research Center in Madison, where he began observational and experimental studies of reconciliation behavior in monkeys. He has written a number of books. He received the LA Times Book Award for Peacemaking Among Primates, which is an account of 15 years of research on conflict resolution in non-human primates. He's worked with chimps at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center and with bonobos at the San Diego Zoo. In 1991, he accepted a joint position in the psychology department of Emory and the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. He is the author of Primates and Philosophers, How Morality Evolved, Our Inner Ape, My Family Album, 30 Years of Primate Photography, Chimpanzee Politics, Power and Sex Among Apes, Bonobo, the Forgotten Ape, and the list goes on and on. Some of you may have seen, and this is what caught our interest, the science section of the New York Times on Tuesday had a big, big, long piece about his work and about the beginnings of morality in primate behavior. We'll be welcoming phone calls. We'll have many of them, I'm sure, this hour. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. Dr. Franz de Waal, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
I'm glad to be there.
Yeah, I'm happy to have you with us today. All right, let's look at empathy. I love these stories about empathy. Tell me about chimps, about apes, about empathy, and how it is perhaps a precursor of morality.
Well, the first time we ran into empathy was I was doing studies of actually reconciliation, which is when two individuals come together after a fight and they kiss and embrace, which chimpanzees do, and many other primates do similar things. But in that context, we noticed that the victim of aggression sometimes is approached by bystanders who had nothing to do with the fight, and they embrace the victim, or they groom the victim, or they try, at least they seem to be trying to calm down the victim. And so we called that consolation and started studying it. And since then, I've noticed it in many apes, at least. In monkeys, it doesn't really occur. But in many apes, you see that kind of behavior. And we know it occurs in pets also. There's an interesting study that was done by Carolyn Zahn Wachsler, who's now, I believe, in Wisconsin, who did studies on children. And her goal was to see if one-year-old children already console individuals who are sick or coughing or sobbing in the family. And in the context of that study, she discovered that, yes, one-year-old kids do that, but also the dogs in the family would do that.
Yes.
And they would come over to people and put their head in their lap. And so according to her criteria, if you use the same criteria for children and for dogs, the dogs were doing empathy just as well.
Yeah, those of us who have dogs, I think, can say, you're right, we see it all the time, right?
Yeah, I think it has been overlooked by science, partly because for ages we were not allowed to talk about animal emotions. Animals have no emotions, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And also the biologists, and I'm a biologist, but I'm still saying that the biologists had this view of nature that everything is nasty and competitive and whatever. And so there was no room for things like sympathy or empathy.
Mm-hmm. So let me really simplify this, but see if we're on target here with what you're saying. You are arguing that human morality would be impossible if we didn't have certain emotional building blocks that you are seeing and have for years now in chimpanzee and monkey societies.
Yeah, if you were to remove empathy from human psychology, Well, we have people like that, like psychopaths. We usually say they have no empathy. So if we were just a society of psychopaths, we would not be a very moral society, in our current opinion, at least.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you remove certain emotions, such as the feeling of responsibility and obligation, empathy and sympathy, following rules and enforcing rules, if you were to remove these very simple building blocks that I see in primate societies, all of human morality would sort of fall apart. It would not hold up. So, for example, our famous golden rule, do unto others, do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Mm-hmm.
That's a rule of reciprocity on the one hand, but it's also a rule of empathy. You need to sort of figure yourself in the position of somebody else to understand what is good for the other and what is good for yourself and compare the two. And so all of these elements of human morality go back to what David Hume, the old Scottish philosopher, he called it the moral sentiments. You need some sort of basic set of moral sentiments, otherwise you can never get to morality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very different view from the view that is very popular among philosophers. Most philosophers have become Kantians. And Kant didn't have a lot of patience with emotions. Kant thought everything was rationally decided.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm certainly not a Kantian, because I don't see how you can decide on morality. Morality is something in your gut. There's actually experiments that psychologists have done. People reach moral conclusions much faster than you would think if it was a rational process. So they have immediate decisions, moral decisions. If you then ask them to explain them, they sometimes have a lot of trouble and they need to think and whatever. But the decisions are made on a sort of intuitive basis, which is exactly what Hume would say, is that it is an emotional process, and yes, cognition and rationality come into it at some point, but not immediately.
Mm-hmm. So is it or is it not somehow hardwired into our brains?
Oh, no, I think it's fairly flexible, like everything that we do. So I don't think, for example, most moral rules are universal. I think what is universal is that we all of us have morality. All humans in the world do have moral systems. And all moral systems are preoccupied with hurting and helping, as I call it. The two H's of morality is you, under which circumstances can you hurt or should you not hurt somebody? At which circumstances should you help somebody? And so those are always the preoccupations of moral systems.
Mm-hmm.
So that's universal. It's a bit like language.
Mm-hmm.
Language is universal, but which language exactly you speak is filled in by the environment, so to speak.
Let me ask you to amplify on this. You were quoted in the Times article as saying, human morality may be severely limited by having evolved as a way of banding together against adversaries, with moral restraints being observed only toward the in-group, not toward outsiders. You say the profound irony is that our noblest achievement, morality, has evolutionary ties to our basest behavior, which is warfare.
Yeah, already Darwin, when he was speculating about morality, he said it must have to do with strengthening the group. And why would you strengthen the group? Well, mainly to fight with other groups. And so Darwin was already speculating that morality is a in-group bonding mechanism that makes it possible to be highly cooperative for humans. Because basically what morality does is it places community values above individual values. So we have all sorts of rules that constrain individual behavior.
Mm.
And if that's the case, if it is mainly to strengthen in-group, that also explains why, for example, morality is not easily applied outside of the group. So we're very concerned about the in-group, but not so much concerned about the out-group. Just to say it very bluntly, for example, at the moment with the Iraq war, at some point, I believe, people asked the government how many people had died during the Iraq war, and they would say 2,000 or 3,000, whatever it is, Americans who have died. And the journalists would say, but that's not all. There's a lot of Iraqis who
died.
Right,
yeah.
And I believe that Rumsfeld or Cheney, one of the two, said, well, we don't count those.
Right.
Well, yes. That's exactly the attitude of human morality.
Mm.
It's like, our dead are very important, but those dead, who cares about those? And so I think human morality is very strongly biased towards the in-group. And it is a struggle. We all feel nowadays in our modern societies, I think we all feel we need to extend morality. We need to go beyond our own group. We need to look at universal human rights, for example. Mm. We may even look at animal rights. We need to look beyond ourselves. And that's a struggle, because I don't think moral systems were designed for that.
Have you, Dr. DeWall, in your many years of studying primates, found instances where they will reach beyond their own group, maybe even to another species, and be moral animals?
Yeah. For example, there's a famous story of a bonobo named Cooney, who found a little bird in her enclosure at a zoo in England. And the bird had flown against the glass, and so the bird was not in very good shape. And she took the bird, and she went to the highest point of her enclosure, which was a tree, and she took the bird in her two hands and unfolded the little wings and tried to send it out like a little airplane, which is very interesting, because there would be something she would never do with another bonobo, but she did it with a bird, as if she was taking the position, like for a bird, this would be good. Mm-hmm. And so those are sort of higher forms of empathy. That's not just a sort of emotional empathy, but there's a certain imagination that comes with it, and a certain trying to imagine what would be good for somebody else. And I do think that primates in captivity do this sort of thing because they are not under very strong pressure to eat, or because they have enough food and they have enough care. In the wild, I'm not sure that a bonobo would do this. I'm pretty sure it would try to eat the bird. And so that's a funny thing with empathy. Empathy is subject to all sorts of priority systems, and so you cannot have empathy for everybody all the time, because you would die if you did that. So we have to set priorities, and our highest priority for empathy is obviously with people who are close to us, so family and friends, and there's actually lots of experiments at the moment that we do with humans in brain scanners, and see how empathy works in the human species. But with primates, I would say the same. If you have primates who have an easy time and have enough of food, they may show actually empathy with other creatures. But, you know, if they're under stress, then other priorities kick in.
And yet we need to work as human beings to reach out to that outgroup, to have empathy for more. We may start with our family, but we also need to know how many Iraqis died.
Yes, but again, also with humans, this is subject to whether you can afford it. Sometimes that's forgotten, is that as soon as, let's say, the U.S. would have a massive famine, all the food disappears and everyone is starving, you will see that empathy towards outgroups will drop very dramatically, will disappear almost. So for us, too, we are capable of empathy with outgroups, and we are capable of discussing universal human rights, and that's all wonderful and should be done. But it's sort of predicated on the wealth that we currently have, so that we can afford these sort of things. Because the highest level of loyalty that we have and that primates have is towards the in-group and the own family. And so if everybody is starving, you know, the only thing you care about is yourself and your immediate family, and the rest you really don't care so much about.
Referencing this article again, because I find this an astounding statement. Chimps who can't swim have drowned in zoo moats trying to save others.
Yeah, this is chimpanzees, and this is true for other primates as well. They take sometimes incredible risks on behalf of somebody else. And to explain that, I think this cannot be explained. The usual explanation for many biologists of this kind of behavior is reciprocity. They say, okay, they're doing this because they will get help back in the future. Well, I don't think a chimp who's going to dive into the moat, whereas he knows he cannot swim, and normally they're scared to death of water, at that moment he's making some sort of calculation, I will be helped in the future. I must assume a very strong emotional drive to do this sort of thing, which must be based on empathy or sympathy or whatever we call it. And so there's other cases like primates who support each other in fights. Let's say you have a female who's being attacked by a big male, and her female friend comes over and defends her. Well, that female friend is taking an incredible risk because these males have big teeth and they can slash you open before you know it. And so, and she knows that she's taking an enormous risk because they are certainly familiar with that kind of risks. And so, she needs to have a very strong emotional impetus to get to the even to the point of showing this kind of support.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm saying that you don't get there by just by reciprocity, as many biologists think, because you need to get into a motivational state that makes you take enormous risk. And I don't think you get there by gamble on the future, as they would say.
Right. We're going to welcome phone calls. We already have many lines going. One line is open if you'd like to join the conversation with Dr. Franz Dewall. He's director of the Living Links Center at Emory University, established in 1997 for primate studies that shed light on human behavioral evolution. His latest book is Primates and Philosophers, How Morality Evolved, Our Inner Ape. He's also author of that and a number of other books. He has been studying primates for a long time. And this article in the science section of the Times yesterday, actually, looked at the beginnings of morality in primate behavior and how this has been controversial. And certainly Dr. Dewall's ideas some years ago were considered extremely controversial because many philosophers found it hard to think of animals as moral beings. He says that human morality would be impossible without certain emotional building blocks that are clearly at work in chimp and monkey societies. All right, let's go to you in a moment. 800-486-8655, 227-2050 for those of you who are calling in Milwaukee. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Okay, we go to phone calls now, and we start our calls with John from Madison. Hi, John.
Hello. When I think about human instincts, I think something that's really proven to be helpful to me is to think about the term open-ended instincts. In other words, we have instincts, but we fill them in with cultural specifics. That's just an off-the-wall comment. But my actual question is this. I read a disturbing chapter in a book about whether humans have male humans have an innate instinct to go to war, and he, as a basis for this, he gave the example of the common chimp, Pan troglodytes, not the Pan paniscus, the bonobo, but the other species, the common chimp. And he said that 30% of every generation of males is lost in this constant patrolling and intergroup raiding. In other words, they're killed by other chimp, male chimps. And then they looked, a bunch of anthropologists looked, went over old data in South America, Africa, and New Guinea, and they found that in human primitive hunter-gatherer societies, they found 25% of males in these societies had died, and specifically the same types of behavior exhibited in the chimps. And I just wondered if you see some kind of instinctual small group impetus to go to warfare on the part of humans, as you know, referring back to our chimp ancestors, which we broke up with, 5 million years ago.
Dr. Dewall.
Yeah, so the question is whether the last common ancestor between us and chimps did the same thing. So for humans, for example, the evidence for warfare in humans goes back 15,000 years, which is not much. So there's not much evidence from before that. I'm willing to believe that we had warfare before that. But there was also a time when there were very few humans on Earth. So, for example, it is estimated that a couple of thousand years ago, if we go back maybe 5,000 to 10,000 years ago, there were barely a million humans all over the world. So the world was extremely thinly populated. We now have 6 billion or whatever it is. And the hunter-gatherers of today, except for a few groups, are not particularly warrior-like. So most anthropologists that I talk with, they say that 90% of the time or more, hunter-gatherers live very peaceful lives and have exchange relationships with the neighbors and so on. And so it is possible that human warfare started with the agricultural revolution, where we started to settle down and have possessions, and where it became interesting maybe to have warfare. And for chimpanzees, it is possible that they have been doing it for 6 million years, But it's also possible that we really don't know that if the last common ancestor was more bonobo-like. Bonobos are certainly not like chimpanzees. We've never observed killings among bonobos. And so all of this is sort of speculative. I know that some people believe that we are inherently an aggressive species and we like to kill each other, and we must have been doing that for 6 million years, but I question that. I'm not sure about that.
Huh. Well, can I ask, I don't know if this is even a question, but are we, is our makeup sort of half bonobo, half chimp, or some variation thereof?
Well, I've argued in another book, which is Our Inner Ape, that we are bipolar in the sense that we have a little bit of a bonobo and a little bit of a chimp.
Right.
We have, on the gentle side, we have a lot of things that are very interesting, empathy, sympathy, helping behavior that is very highly developed in our species. But we clearly are also a very aggressive species, and we don't mind going to war and killing other people. And so, yes, we have a little bit of both. And we sort of reconciling the two most of the time. And I think what comes out of us is mainly a product of the circumstances. And so if you live under circumstances where warfare pays, then you probably will engage in it.
Hmm. Thanks, John, for your call. Todd is next from Appleton. Hi, Todd.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question on human beings, and if you saw this in chimpanzees or what have you. We all have family members or what have you that, like the golden rule, you're talking about empathy, and that's a great point because I never heard that before, because I feel I have a lot of empathy and it works. But I see people that I know, people, family members, what have you, that know other people that can complain about the other person not doing the golden rule, yet they don't really apply it themselves. So my question is, where's the bipolar? Where's the disconnect? How can one person know the golden rule inside and out, have all the empathy, but not utilize it themselves? Where's the disconnect?
So what you're basically talking about is hypocrisy or something?
Yeah.
Because,
it's really in them. It's hard to change that. It's not like they're faking it. It's just that's how they are. So what's in the brain that makes that happen?
No, I understand what you mean. So the three levels that I see in human morality, and the first level I think we share with the primates, is the first level is moral emotions like sympathy, empathy, reciprocity, following rules, establishing rules, enforcing them, and so on. I think all of that you can find somewhat in the primates. Then the second level is more complex, and you find some of it in the primates, but much less of it, which is social pressure, where you put pressure on everybody and you say everybody has to follow these rules. And then the third level is a level that I think is not really present in the primates, which is moral reasoning, and I don't want to get into that. But now what your question has to do with the social pressure issue is people, and that's where you get this disconnect sometimes. People are used to putting moral pressure on everybody, like you need to act like this, you need to act like that, and they're just not as good as putting that same pressure on themselves usually. So people are, in that sense, they favor themselves, so to speak. They have a consciousness which applies very well to others and sometimes not so well to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is inherent in the pressure system that we have, that you get some degree of hypocrisy in that system, in the sense some degree of people who are very eager to apply the rules to others but not to themselves. It's a bit like the televangelist who tells everyone how to behave, and then one day we find out he went to the prostitutes every day, and then they come on the camera and they apologize, and you know the case, and we have that kind of hypocrites all around us, and that's sort of inherent in the pressure system that we have.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more? I know you've discussed this a little bit, Dr. Dhawal, about the good of the community, that if we're going to live in community, social living requires empathy. You talk about the actions that are undertaken by every species, I believe, of ape and monkey, having their own protocol for reconciliation after fights. The motivation is that we're all in this together?
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think there is a certain group sense in the primates, and I would say not just in the primates. This must apply also to pack hunting animals like killer whales or wolves, or pack animals like elephants, who live in tight communities that are highly cooperative. you get this sense of community where someone who disturbs the community disturbs just more than just one relationship. It disturbs everything. And so, for example, chimpanzee females, they will bring males together after fights. So let's say two males have an enormous fight. They don't reconcile immediately. Then you may have an old female who literally takes one of the males by the hand and leads him to the other male to bring them together. Hmm. And so she's fixing a problem in her community. And I don't think she's necessarily doing that just for her own purposes. She's doing that because at the community level, this is very disturbing to have this kind of fight. And it's also very harmful for low-ranking individuals if the males remain very tense because they may take it out on them. Or females will go over to males who are about to fight and remove the weapons from their hands in order to make the fight less dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see that kind of actions. In addition to, in order to return to the issue that we had right before about social pressure, there is a certain social pressure on behavior. And a story that I like to tell is what happened long ago at the zoo where I worked. We had the rule that all the chimps had to come off the island indoors, and only if all the chimps were indoors would we feed them and give them their evening meal.
Mm-hmm.
And so normally they would all rush inside. They were very hungry and eager to be in the rooms. But one night when it was warm and nice weather, two young females, two teenage females basically, they stayed outside. And so they stayed out for many hours. And at 9 o'clock at night, they were still not in. And at some point they came in and we separated them and we fed everybody at that point. But the next morning, we let out all the chimps. So we had basically forgotten about the incident, but the chimps had not.
Huh.
And they beat up those two females.
Huh.
They chased them all around the island. And the same evening, they were the first ones to come in, of course. This was a human rule, but the chimps were enforcing the rule.
Uh-huh.
And so this is a good example of social pressure and the distinction between acceptable and unacceptable behavior, which I think chimpanzees also make.
Yeah, oh, that's quite a story. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Al next from Milwaukee. Hi, Al.
Hi. The story about the bonobo in captivity versus the bonobo in the wild. Mm-hmm. One would have played with the bird, and the other may have eaten the bird. Is there any evidence that comparative societies, countries, nations, some that provide more social welfare programs have less crime or less attacking one on the other than, say, a society that provides fewer social programs and forces people pretty much to be on their own, that has increased crime?
Yeah, I'm not sure that there's a systematic connection. Of course, if you compare, let's say, the U.S. with Europe, but I don't know all the countries that you could potentially compare, but the U.S. has a much higher murder rate, like 10 or 20 times higher than Europe, and the U.S. has far fewer social programs. I do think what you get, if you have less of a security network in a society, you get more sort of outcasts or let's say a poor underclass almost. And the U.S. has 40 million people are not insured for health.
Mm-hmm.
So the U.S. has an enormous poor underclass, which is almost asking, you ask for problems if you create that in a society, because people do need to live and people do need to eat. And so if they have no other means, they're going to go into crime, and that's why maybe the crime rates are so high and why also the U.S. has a much higher incarceration rate and the highest in the world, basically. The U.S. has more prisoners than any other country in the world.
Mm.
And so, yes, I do think those things are somewhat connected, but I don't know the systematic statistics if you go looking at all the countries in the world and compare all of them.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Al, very much for the call. Bill is next from Washburn. Hi, Bill.
Hi. How you doing?
Fine, Bill. You?
Good.
Good. Go right ahead.
Okay. Hey. Listen, Doc. Do chimps and apes or elephants or dolphins, do they get Alzheimer's? I just finished listening to that Alzheimer's program.
That was on before you were on, Dr. Duvall.
I don't know much about that. I do know that chimpanzees don't get Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. At least that's the claim. I do think chimpanzees, when they get older, they have a cognitive decline, like all of us have. which is not the same as Alzheimer's. So yes, their memory may go down a little, and certain things may become slower. But people say that, and I'm not an expert on it, but people say that Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are two of those diseases that chimps don't seem to have.
Can we talk a little bit about your work? The article talked about the fact that you had had, and I'll quote here, battles with psychologists over giving emotional states to animals, and it has taken you some 20 years to come back to this subject because a lot of people came around to your point of view.
Yeah, you know, there's sort of two battles that need to be fought in this kind of area. One is that there are certain biologists who believe that the world is inherently nasty and selfish, and we are inherently nasty and selfish. Mm. And so they don't want to hear about kind behavior in animals. And if there is kind behavior, it must be fake. So they even claim that for humans. If humans are moral, it's just because they want to make a good impression on each other. And there's actually a very famous quote from a biologist who in the 70s said, "You scratch an altruist and you watch a hypocrite bleed." And his argument was that it cannot be a true altruist because they cannot exist. So that's one end of the spectrum. That's the biologists. And then the other end are the psychologists, mostly American behaviorists, as they're usually called. These are psychologists trained in the Skinnerian school, that everything is conditioning, and animal emotions and animal minds and animal intentions you shouldn't be talking about. And yeah, so that's another battle that I've been engaged in. And their usual argument, if you say that animals have empathy or reconciliation or whatever term, or fairness, I've written about fairness in primates, if you use the kind of terms, they say it's anthropomorphic. Mm-hmm. That's their big weapon, and anthropomorphic is bad.
Right.
And I've argued systematically that if you take a Darwinian position, you cannot follow the same rules as these behaviorists. The Darwinian position should be that if you see a behavior that is very similar to our behavior in a chimpanzee, let's say males form coalitions to achieve power, which they do, male chimpanzees. So if you see very similar behavior in the chimpanzee to our behavior, and it's expressed similarly, and it seems to function similarly, then you have to assume that the psychology behind it is very similar too. That would be the Darwinian position, because to assume otherwise, to say that, oh no, chimpanzees cannot have politics because that's anthropomorphic, to assume otherwise is basically imposing a difference where there may be absolutely no difference because we are very closely related to chimpanzees. And so I've always argued the opposite. I call it that these people who argue this case, that they are an anthropo-denial, which is my counterword to anthropomorphism. They try to deny the connections with the human species that are obviously there and that have to be there because we share an enormous amount of evolutionary history with the chimpanzee.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call, Bill. Let's go to Robert next. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Right. I've got a question that fits perfectly with where you were talking about. Sylvan Tompkins, about 40 years ago, was really the first modern psychologist who showed a basis for innate emotion in human beings. And his work was pretty much neglected until 20, 25 years later. But one of the things that he described was shame or shame humiliation as an innate emotion or affect in humans. And that could be described physically as involving a loss of tone in the neck, head goes down, eyes tend to go over to the left and down. There's sort of a general loss of motor tone. There's a blushing. All of that is, in his system, thought to be innate. Yet the only use of shame you'll find with most psychologists still is as a self-conscious emotion that you can't have until you're about 3 years old. So I've been looking for this in other animals. I think I've occasionally been able to distinguish something in dogs that looks like shame that I don't think is just, say, an approach with fear inhibition. But I'm wondering if you've seen this in chimpanzees.
Well, that's a very interesting question. You know that Darwin already said that because he was writing about the facial expressions of humans and apes, that the only expression he'd never seen in apes was blushing. And blushing is something we do when we're ashamed. And I think he's right. Blushing is not something that I know. And I think shame and guilt are very complex emotions that are probably not found, or not, if they are found, not very well developed in other primates. So, for example, guilt. I know that many people believe that their dogs have guilt. You come home, the dog has done something wrong.
Right.
The dog hides under the table,
right.
And we say, oh, he feels guilty. But actually, the dog may be anticipating punishment, which is a very different thing. Mm. But I think the two are related in the sense that if you look at young children, they don't start with guilt. They start with knowing when they get punished by somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only later that this is internalized. Mm. And when we internalize the anticipation of punishment, it becomes guilt. And so I think there's an interesting experiment that the veterinarian did with dogs to show that it was not guilt what the dogs were doing. What they would do is this was a dog who would shred garbage bags in the kitchen. And so what they did one day is some experimenter stayed in the home, and he did the shredding of the garbage bag. So he shred a bag and threw everything around the kitchen. The dog didn't do anything wrong. The owner came home, and the dog acted exactly the same as before. And so they said, well, the dog is not really guilty because he didn't do anything, but the dog is reacting exactly the same. So I think we have to be very careful with these kind of very complex emotions like guilt and shame. But who knows? There may come a day that people can demonstrate it in animals, but I have not seen a lot of strong evidence for it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, surely there's a complex emotion, but for every complex adult emotion, we have a word, and typically we also have a word for the more primitive affect, anger to anger.
Mm-hmm.
So we can talk about anger as a complex adult emotion, or we can talk about anger as a simple innate affect. I think there's an equivalent of that. There's a complex shame, and certainly guilt is complex. It's more complex, really.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also an almost immediate reaction to the interruption of positive affect. And you can see that in infants, 7 months, 8 months old, around the time of stranger anxiety. You can even see something like that in a 2 or 3 month old infant. This is demonstrated by the Papuseks in Czechoslovakia years ago.
If it occurs if it is a phenomenon that occurs in, let's say, a 6 month old human infant, I would be surprised if it doesn't occur in chimpanzees. That would be surprising. Because I don't think very young children are in their emotional life fundamentally different from a chimpanzee. But then it is probably some sort of precursor of shame. I don't know how we would call it, because we don't probably have a word for it, but it would not be full-blown shame then, I suppose.
Thanks very much for your call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We are this hour speaking with Dr. Franz De Waal, who is director of the Living Links Center at Emory University, established for primate studies that shed light on human behavioral evolution. He has studied primates for many, many years. He is originally from the Netherlands. He has a PhD in biology. His dissertation concerned aggressive behavior and alliance formation in macaques. He has a Wisconsin tie as well. He, in 1981, came to the United States and to the Wisconsin Regional Primate Research Center in Madison. He has won all kinds of awards for his many, many books, and we're welcoming phone calls for him at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. His most recent book is Primates and Philosophers, How Morality Evolved. He's also author of Our Inner Ape, Peacemaking Among Primates, written some years ago, Good Natured, The Origins of Right and Wrong in Humans and Other Animals, and the list goes on. I'm Kathleen Dunn. A couple lines are open. We've been crowded here, so if you'd like to get a place, just take one of those right now. 800-486-8655. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, Clive Crook, who is a senior editor for the Atlantic Monthly, his article, The Phantom Menace, What War on the Middle Class, appears in the April issue of the magazine. Back to phone calls. We go to Michael from Superior next. Hi, Michael.
Well, good morning, Kathleen, and hello to your guest. I have just a quick comment and a question. One is that I have a personal example. I was about 6 or 7 years old and jumped into this mill pond, and my father, who could not swim, jumped in with all his clothes on. I was welling over my head. I would have drowned for sure.
Hmm.
And he pulled me out of that mill pond.
Hmm.
And it was just, he's never been able to swim. He had all his clothes on, and I was just one of these loose cannons, you know, a little 6-7-year-old kid jumping in the water. That was like 60 years ago. But anyways, I thought that that would go nicely along with what the primate did for his own partner out there.
And right, right.
The question I have is that I would like the guest to comment on the fact that it seems to me that could it be that once the human raised himself above all life forms and created religious structures, that this might explain in a large measure, but not completely, some of the, if not all of the aggressive behavior, even the casting and creating the understanding of guilt and shame and so forth, that was given to humanity once they moved themselves from all of life.
Mm. I'm glad you brought up the area of religion. Dr. DeWolf.
Okay. My feeling is that religion is a more recent phenomenon than morality. The reason I think that is that the equivalent of religion, I don't see much of that in the primates. Equivalents of morality, I see a lot of that. So I think to have a community and to have rules within the community and to have bonding and cohesion within a community that needs to be enforced and regulated, all of that makes sense for social animals and makes sense for our ancestors. So probably that's all extremely old. Whereas our current religions are just a couple of thousand years old, and probably there were religions before that time, but I'm not sure that religion is as old as morality. And so the way I look at religion is something that came in later and that we use to reinforce the moral system. And so religions get involved in it, obviously, and they provide some sort of organization and rationale for the morality that we have, but that we already had before the religions came. And then, of course, the religions like to co-opt the whole thing, and religions like to act as if they invented morality, but I don't think that's actually the case.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do believe that things like guilt and shame probably existed long before the religions came along, but they're certainly exploited big time by the religions.
Yeah. Thanks very much for your call. We go next to Nellie is next from Rock County. Hi, Nellie.
Hi. Many years ago, I saw a Jane Goodall television show, and it was filmed in the wild. And there was this group of chimpanzees, and the head guy, for some reason that wasn't apparent to me, lost it. And he had what I could only describe as a tantrum.
Hmm.
And he raised holy hell and jumped around and yelled and screamed, and all the other tribal members cowered away in the brush. And then when he calmed down, all the males lined up one after another and came up to him, and he hugged him and embraced him. And I wondered, have you ever seen that kind of behavior in chimpanzees?
No, that's typical behavior. The male, the alpha male, on occasion, usually once a day or so, he needs to scare the hell out of everybody. And so he will walk in swaggering and beat up somebody, and for the rest, most of it is what we call bluff. He has his hair up, and in captivity they will bang doors, and in the wild they will uproot little trees. And so they go around and impress everybody.
Hmm.
And the main ones to impress are actually not the females or the young ones, are his potential rivals. So that they see, oh, this guy is in very good health and very strong, and we better not mess with him. And so he makes that deep impression on everybody, and then he sits down. And when he sits down, the whole community is supposed to pay homage to him and is supposed to come over and bow and pant grunt, as we call it, to show their submission to him. And interestingly enough, we have indications that these alpha males watch extremely carefully who's coming over to them.
Hmm.
And so we've had occasions, this is in captive studies that we do at the moment, where if a certain, let's say, an adolescent male forgets to come to him and bow for him, he knows that, and 10 minutes later, he goes over there and beats up the young male who forgot to greet him. And so they seem to keep an eye on all of this, a bit like I think human alpha males do. They keep a very close eye on how others behave towards them, And if you are in a company and you have a boss and you are not deferential enough, you probably get into trouble.
It's true. Thanks very much for your call. We go next to Carol. Hi, Carol. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm just loving this program. It's blowing my mind, kind of, because what I do, I'm a middle school trainer for bully prevention. As you know, bullying in our schools is very important that we address those issues. But I wonder if I'm training a bunch of chimpanzees. What's difficult is our focus primarily is now to empower the bystander. And the part of the research that's most intriguing to me is that innate morality, you know, the innate ability to know when you should help and you should hurt, and that you only really care about your people. And in middle schools, there's so many cliques, and it's so evident. And my question is, I'm wondering what the doctor, you know, how can you extrapolate your research into how I can help empower my little chimpanzees and help empower that silent majority?
Yeah, okay. Well, the scene that I just described for an alpha male who makes a deep impression on everybody, the thing is that the more powerful and secure the position of a high-ranking individual like that, the less violence he will use. It's actually very interesting. If you have an alpha male who is supported by the community, everyone likes him, he's a good leader, and so his position has become extremely stable, he barely uses any violence at all. Because he doesn't need to. He was just a display, like I just described. He already makes a very deep impression.
Mm-hmm.
The bullies, the one who beat up everybody, are the ones who are insecure about their position. So in a chimpanzee society, you may have a young male who's rising in status, but he cannot really get any much further beyond position 4 or 5 or whatever it is. And he's insecure about where he stands. And he's the one who's going to be violent. And so I think bullying in schools is actually very interesting, because I bet that if you analyze it in terms of dominance relationships, you get much further. The problem is that many psychologists consider dominance and power dirty words, and they don't want to be associated with it. And if I describe the power of relationships among chimpanzees, they sometimes come up to me and they say, oh, so you approve of power? And I'm not approving of anything. I'm just describing what my chimps are doing. And I think if you would take that attitude towards children at school and analyze things in terms of who gets attention, who is followed as a leader, who is dominant over others, and build hierarchies and look at that from the dominance perspective, as we do in primatology all the time, you probably get a lot of answers that you're not getting, because the psychology vocabulary has sort of banned power and dominance from it.
Yeah. Thanks so much for your call. Our number is 800-480. Oh, you're still there, Carol. Are you still there, Carol? No, she's not. 800-486-8655 is our number, 227-2050. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, I wanted to ask you slightly a side issue here, but the last time we spoke, Dr. Dwal, you were talking about self-awareness in animals, and you were studying elephants in New York, I think, and I'm wondering what you've discovered since we last spoke on that.
Oh, we don't have a discovery every week, though. So we did the mirror study on the elephants. And actually, that study relates to the topic of morality, because I believe that certain animals are very well known for altruistic acts and helping behavior and empathy, and that these higher forms of empathy you get only if you have perspective taking. So if you can take the perspective of somebody else, and that requires a high level of self-identity and self-awareness. And so since elephants and dolphins are so well known, apart from the great apes, for these kind of helping actions, we felt that the elephant needed to be tested with a mirror. And as I told this story last time, we decided to give them a very big mirror, because people had tested elephants before with little mirrors that were far away and they didn't do anything with them. And so at the Bronx Zoo, we built a huge mirror, elephant-sized mirror, that was elephant-resistant also, so that they could inspect it up close, and we got positive results. And so the elephant has now joined the animal elite, so to speak, that recognizes itself in the mirror.
And those are, who are those animals now?
Those three elephants at the Bronx Zoo, you mean?
No, it's the elephants, it's the dolphins.
The dolphin, and the great apes, and humans.
And humans.
And for the rest, people have tested all sorts of animals, and I know the dog stories that everyone will now call to you probably. But no, dogs don't recognize themselves in the mirror, as far as I know.
Yeah. You're just fascinating. Thank you so much for being with us today. I love the hour. Thanks.
Okay, well, you're welcome. Thank you.
Dr. Franz de Waal, he is director of the Living Links Center at Emory University. It was established for primate studies back in 1997, shedding light on human behavioral evolution. There's a big piece on him in the science section of the New York Times, yesterday's paper, that looks at the beginnings of morality in primate behavior, and it is the subject of his latest book. He's the author of all kinds of books, and so we were talking a little bit about his most recent book here. And thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the program, and to Diana Dentino and Mimi Notstein for on-air production here in our studios in the Milwaukee area. Thanks for all of your calls, everybody. It was a good hour. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and then we will continue with our Wednesday conversation, and stay tuned. It should be another good hour. There's what I was looking for. I'm sorry if I was shuffling papers. His latest book is Primates and Philosophers, How Morality Evolved, just published last year, and we last spoke with him about our inner ape. This is the Ideas Network.